Welcome back to the M&A Zing, the weekly podcast for acquisition entrepreneurs, holdco builders, and search fund investors in the UK, Europe, and beyond. I'm your host, Gareth Hawkins, co-founder and CEO of BizCrunch, the end-to-end platform and AI-powered tool suite for small business succession M&A. Today, we are super lucky. We are continuing our series of interviews, and this time with one of the increasing number of capital allocators helping to make search and SMB buyout equity gap funding accessible to a broader base of investors. This gentleman is Alexander Kallis, who has in recent months brought into the world the BORING Investment Club, hot on the back of launching a Archimax Solutions after a very illustrious career in investment management and founding and running various platforms, including a multifamily office. So, Alex, welcome. Lovely to have you with us.
Thanks, Gareth, and big fan of the show. So thanks for having me.
That's very kind. Big fan of what you're doing. And we first came into each other's orbit, I think, just in the advent of the Serial Acquirers Symposium, which now feels like a lifetime ago, but was actually only about 4 months, such as being the whirlwind of 2025. I think we were both, as sort of technical investors with an understanding of capital raising and investment agreement structuring and liquidation preferences and all the things that come with the alchemy of capital allocation. I think we were sort of drawn to the model and the opportunities at a similar sort of time. So great to have been able to be on the same journey in the same vein, but approaching it from slightly different angles and trying to achieve solutions for different parts of the ecosystem, because we're all building the aircraft at 30,000 feet right now.
Absolutely. There's a place for everyone in the ecosystem. So
And it's not quite big enough yet. So let's keep on keeping on. So let's get into your background, if we can. I always like to start there, and you know, the journey to this point. You started your career in institutional investment management. So I think you have worked within the Rothschild operation and Santander as a sort of fund of hedge funds before you started founding your own operations. So give us a little bit of a tour of how that played out.
Absolutely. So, yeah, so my background is I'm originally Belgian, but I was born in the US, grew up until I was 10 in the US, and did my studies in Belgium. And my plan was to move back to the US originally, but I found a job at in M&A, actually, at UBS initially. And that was in London. And so I thought, well, it's on the way to the US. Let's start there. 25 years later, I'm still here. But it's been a good experience so far. So look, I started at UBS. It was an internship, and I still remember, you know, being in the room actually during 9/11. That's when we were all looking at these, you know, very pixelated screens, watching, trying to understand what was happening there. But other than that experience, you know, it was a great learning curve on everything to do with M&A, actually. And then eventually I decided I wanted to move into the investment side of things. And so I moved over and joined Rothschild, Edmond Rothschild, which had a big fund of hedge fund program. And I was allocated the Asian space. So looking after and meeting hedge fund managers and due diligencing them and basically running a portfolio. And at the time it was the oldest Asian fund of hedge funds that had been launched and the largest. And when I joined, we had about 300 million under management. And by the time I left, we had 1.3 billion. So it had grown significantly. We rode the, you know, noughties up with along with the emergence of the asset class in Asia, and there's a lot of parallels to what we're doing today now in the ETA space, actually, which I'll touch on later.
Would love you to. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned riding a wave there, but I'm sure there was a lot of hard work to actually cram the capital in and attract it from the right places and steer it to the right destinations in order to grow the AUM like that. But that's quite a wave.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Obviously, it helps to have a big brand name behind you, and you know the power of brand recognition in banking does help. And so it wasn't all down to me, but I'd like to think I had a little part of it. But eventually, I moved over to Santander, and they had also a fund of hedge fund program. They didn't have anyone covering Asia. They had a $300 million portfolio focused on Asia. Actually, it was Japan first, and then they wanted me to expand into cover Asia. So it was a great opportunity for me. And yeah, the only tricky part was that they were exposed during the financial crisis to the big Madoff Ponzi scheme. And
oh, really?
That was a big learning curve for me. I got very frustrated. Obviously, as you can imagine, that's, you know, I was doing my little Asian thing on the side, and things happened in other parts of the organization, which basically brought the division to a close. And so it really taught.
It was fatal.
It was fatal for the business. And so I, but I learned a lot. You know, obviously, the issue I had was that I had managed my fund quite well. Liquidity, I had raised a lot of cash within the portfolio. I had made sure that I had aligned liquidity of the underlying managers to something that was manageable. And so basically, as everyone was trying to pull their money out, I got treated like an ATM machine and was the first fund to be able to be liquidated. And despite having the best performance in the group and of most of the other Asian hedge funds, actually. So it was very frustrating, but there it is. And also it taught me a lot of things with respect to due diligence and the importance of it, something that I'm applying now and actually throughout my career. And so very quickly, I then moved on and decided I didn't want to be subject to working for a big organization where I didn't have control anymore. And with a friend of mine, we started a SaaS-based due diligence and consulting firm for the Asian hedge fund and emerging market hedge funds industry at a time when a lot of people were, a lot of banks and groups were cutting down their exposure their people on the ground. And I thought, you know, it'd be a good idea to provide them with outsourced consulting solutions for that part of the market that I by that time I knew quite well. So it was a bit of a baptism by fire into the entrepreneurship. Did we have the perfect product market fit and idea? I think there were a lot of mistakes that were made. I can certainly go into them. But eventually we landed a few clients, and our biggest clients went on and after 2 years of operation acquired us. And so that was a good experience. I then went on and co-founded a global asset management firm called Miltrust International. We were based in London, Singapore, and Abu Dhabi eventually at the end. And we grew from doing fund of funds, fund of managed accounts, public market equities. And then we expanded into the private markets, and where we launched a real assets program focused on farmland investing in Australia and New Zealand, but also a big venture capital program. And our clients were pension funds, family offices, institutions. And collectively, we raised over $1 billion across the different programs. We were also helping, with financing and raising money for individual companies and venture capital and startups. And really interesting space. I think we did really well. Most of our, if not all of our venture capital investments have done very well. We even exited and had a liquidity event with the fund. We had some unicorns in there. So it was a really great moment to be in VC. And we were focusing on the university tech spin-out world from the UK university ecosystem. And I can get into a little bit of detail later on some of the things we were backing. But anyway, so and in parallel to that, we also founded a division, which was a multifamily office called East West Private Wealth. And I served as CEO of that business and group managing partner of the Miltrust business.
So East West, speaking to your experience with Asia and, capital flowing, I guess, in both directions by that time.
Correct. So bridging the East with the West is...
Love that.
Yep.
So you mentioned there, first and foremost, difficult to pick out, I should imagine, a particular success from that, because you've obviously had a few along the way, a few wins, as well as a few slaps in the faces. You mentioned some mistakes. but I guess we don't get that far without having some trip ups along the way. But congrats on all of the various successes from those projects. Could you point to one specific achievement that really stands out that you think, my goodness, if I could die a happy man tomorrow having achieved that?
Well, I think, I mean, there's obviously a number of them that I'm really proud of. And obviously having built Miltrust into a global asset management group with teams all over the world is certainly something I take great pride in. You know, we backed 20 venture capital startups, all doing great, really interesting businesses. We've advised over 40 founders with raising money and also with structuring their business and getting them investor ready and all that. And that's, we've raised quite a bit of money for those groups. I would say that I was quite instrumental in moving and our business to what we call sustainable prosperity. So impact investments was something that was close to my heart. We, on the back of that, I launched the Climate Impact Asia Fund, which was a partnership that I negotiated with the Worldwide Fund for Nature. It was quite a pioneering business. And then we also launched the British Innovation Fund, which was our VC fund, which I mentioned, investing in spin-outs of UK universities. We were invested in food tech, agri-tech, health tech, climate tech, you name it. Quirky, really great stories. In fact, one of our success stories was back in during the COVID times. And before that, actually, we invested in a company called Vasitech, which was the co-creator of the Oxford AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine. So we got to see live the effects of, you know, having our, you know, flu or our COVID jabs injected into such a huge world population. And then that company actually listed on NASDAQ in 2021. So that was a great exit for us. And just to name a few things, I was
impressed. I mean, that's quite some picking ability there. How did you, I mean, I don't want to dwell too long on the VC element of this. This is about late stage buyouts, but I'm really intrigued to know how you picked that in the world of, because at the time it was getting quite busy in terms of like vaccine technology spin outs.
Yeah. In fact, they had another program actually. They were doing something else. And in during COVID, they actually pivoted and focused because they had the technology had on being able to develop something really focused on solving this problem. And so they took the bull by the horns. But look, it was part of the Oxford University ecosystem. It was right in our alley, and we were, you know, lucky and fortunate to have been introduced to them. There you go.
Well, there you are. I think you have the Midas touch, Alex, because it seems that you're that man that's at the right place at the right time. I'm sure there's a lot of diligent research goes into making sure you're at the right place at the right time, but definitely there are a fair few wins there. So I want to, you know, that should really give us hope and assure us that as people operating in this space, to have attracted somebody like yourself who was at the forefront, the dawn of the Asian market opening up, who has experienced the sort of the VC boom and the vintage and the era of great returns in VC, who to now come to ETA and SMB buyouts and see some correlations or see some, you know, opportunities for alpha in a similar way. I'm really interested in because, you know, here you are with this experience under your belt, looking from the wisdom of the years at the next opportunity. I'm really interested in what compelled you to come here.
Absolutely. Look, continuing my story, post-COVID, venture capital took a big hit. We had exited our British Innovation Fund 1, and we had invested some of the proprietary money into 12 different companies, and then COVID hit, everything dried up. We were looking to launch our second fund, and that took longer than we expected. You know, interest rates had gone up, liquidity had gone down, obviously, and the cost of capital was higher. And so people were just searching for more liquid and better yields, which they could obtain without the liquidity risk. So so then that's why we prompted us to move and do our multifamily office, kind of parking the venture capital investments on the side. And I think by that time, look, I loved the technologies, the founders, a lot of fun, but I was a little bit disillusioned with the VC space, you know, where they had the early stage risk, the tech risk, the unicorn risk. Yeah, you're pushing these founders to extreme growth pressures, expecting very well that a portion of your portfolio would fail and you're just betting on the unicorn. And I think that I thought that model was it's just probably not for me entirely. And I thought there were other ways of doing things. And so I was a little bit soul searching, and I came across, I guess, this famous book, Buy Then Build, by Walker Dybul. And that was for me
the Dybul Bible.
Dybul Bible. There you go. And you know, just the concept of being able to acquire 1 to 5 million EBITDA businesses for 3 to 6 times, it just got me really excited. For me, it was the perfect antidote to venture capital. And I thought, well, this is what I need to get into. It just makes so much sense. You know, backed also by the fact that you had this huge succession wave and issue, obviously starting in like in Japan and the US and with the baby boomers and looking to retire now. And you have, I think, 450,000 SME transfers a year with, you know, 2 million people in the community that are subject to that. And if these companies die out, then it's just such a shame to find perfectly well good operating businesses and let them sizzle, basically, or not sizzle, fizzle, that's the word I'm looking for.
Exactly.
So basically I got really enamored with the asset class and the space, and I left MailTrust. I'm still a shareholder. I'm a friendly shareholder. I'm supporting them, and I'm still on the board of the funds, where they have 9 funds in one asset class that I'm still involved in, very happily supporting in many ways. But I wanted to do something else at that stage after 15 years. And so, you know, the first thing I did was, as any kind of ETA acquirer would do, is set up a holding company and look for a bunch of businesses. And I quickly came to the realization that actually, once you buy a business, you have to operate them. And I thought, well, actually, I'm not an operator. It's not my background. And
yeah, it's tricky that. Yeah, it's tricky that you have to get in there and roll your sleeves up. Damn it.
And obviously, you know, the idea was not really to operate them, but to find an operator and have them operate. But then I thought there must be a better way that better suits my experience. And I think, you know, I came full down to the conclusion, well, I had this epiphany with the fund of funds experience that I had. Well, instead of buying businesses outright, why don't I find business buyers and operators that I can back with their experience and create a kind of a portfolio approach of many of these, and apply institutional grade due diligence that I've been familiar with, and applying the same methodology of both fund of funds investments, but also direct private equity or venture capital investments. At the same time, you know, I have 25 years of large investor network that I've built over the years. I haven't pissed off too many people, I think, over the years. So, you know,
actually, you made more of them very happy by the sounds of the results. So.
We'll see, but. But you know, I just realized none of these people have exposure to this kind of lower middle market space. They're obviously well exposed to private equity, venture capital, hedge funds, equities, bonds, the traditional stuff. And for me, this was an asset class that was completely overlooked and undiscovered, and
inaccessible, you might say, as well to many.
Opaque, I would say, and so I thought there was certainly ripe for considering adding this asset class to traditional institutional portfolios as a diversifier, if anything.
So institutions are still yet to really discover this asset class and have a kind of validated route into investing in it. We've spoken about this on this podcast before, about how we're still at the kind of vanguard of educating investors to join the capital allocators and get into this opportunity. I mean, I take your earlier point about the power law being a bit bonkers in VC, and yet there's all this dry powder and all this, you know, crammed in capital that's gone into what is a risky asset class. So here we are with all these cash flowing assets and all these, you know, opportunities for leverage, et cetera, but because they are small and require operators to go in, they've become, you know, they've been kind of off limits. So to be able to solve that, at the moment, it's, you know, you're solving it for family offices, you're solving it for high net worth individuals. To be able to solve that also for institutions, I think, would be a massive unlock.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there are hurdles in the fact that it is a very much a people-driven business and asset class. So we need to see how scalable this is. But there certainly is space for, you know, portfolios of modest size, or like small family offices, or even larger ones. And
plenty of capital to steward into this opportunity. So I'm interested in the thesis because you with Archimax and also with the BORING Investment Club, which we will need to get into as to why you chose that name and its particular thesis. But you are assisting with equity gap funding, which I think is a massive area. You know, we're seeing a growing number of savvy individual investors that are getting into the search phase of certain traditional Stanford model search funds, but then not necessarily following on. So that, that leaves a bit of a gulf because, yes, they get the 1.5 times, you know, pref uplift, but they don't then come with the additional actual necessary capital to get the acquisitions done. You're helping to solve that problem by getting in actually at the equity gap stage and not necessarily just going along for the search phase.
Absolutely.
Can you tell us a bit about what triggered that?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I think I often joke that we're a search fund investor without the fund and without the search. You know, I'm pretty much a man on a mission. I don't have time to wait 2 years for someone to find something. So I'm in a rush. And so, you know, like you said, you know, there's gap funding requirements increasingly so. There's also, I see a risk in the whole search phase failing, you know, whereby maybe a couple of years ago, it was, I think the statistics were around 31% have failed. Now we're getting closer to 43 to 50%. So I think that's not a risk that I wanted my investors and my co-investors to necessarily bear. And yeah, I'd rather go for a deal that's ready in post-LOI. And also the fact that you can, you know, once you have a deal, you have a real target, you have the terms on paper, you have the seller that's aligned, everything's there, and you can actually focus on the DD and get moving with a real case. So yeah.
Great stuff. Great thesis. And delighted to see there's somebody coming in to try and solve that. And that has a bias for action and an impetus for momentum. That is great because, yes, it has been a patient capital game. It has, particularly with backing the traditional searchers, it has been a sort of, you know, 2 year journey. But to know that there are these ready allocators waiting to back these, you know, pending opportunities is tremendous. So I'm sure our listeners will be heartened. So let's get into the name, shall we?
Okay. Well, it's a bit tongue in cheek, obviously. It's actually an acronym, BORING. The acronym is Buyouts of Resilient Income Generating Businesses.
Love that.
I mean, look, I'm not hugely enamored with the name, but it works. And the whole concept is that, you know, boring is beautiful. And for me, it's the antidote to venture capital. It's got, these companies have sticky customers. They're beyond product market fit. They've been around for 20 whatever years, steady cash flows. You know, there's low drama. And that's what I like at this point in time in my life. Reliable, technical, you know, and what's interesting is that I'm not necessarily against growth. You know, I think there is growth to be had, but at least there's a solid baseline from which to grow and operate from. And there's this move away from the hopes and dreams. And it doesn't mean that you can not apply efficiencies and SOPs and bring in some AI things to make it grow. But at least the baseline's there and you're beyond the hopes and dreams that I got disillusioned about with VC.
Yes, indeed. So BORING is beautiful. And actually getting involved at this inflection point where new talent comes in to breed rejuvenation and maybe drive the upside, the alpha that we're looking for from these investments is, coming some way towards VC, but certainly still a country mile away from the high risk factor that, that comes with something going 0 to 1. So yeah. Got it. I think BORING has become synonymous with this asset class in terms of the targets. You know, BORING is safe and beneficial. So, you know, Ms. Sanchez has been very keen to promote BORING as a good thing. So I think we should emphasize that. So tell us about the structure of the vehicle. How does it allocate capital? What kind of LPs or investor partners does it bring? Give us a bit more detail, please, Alex.
Okay, great. I mean, it's pretty simple. It's, I literally launched like 6-7 weeks ago, so it's early days, but members are, it's an invitation only. We can get into that, but it's the idea is to bring across sophisticated professional investors from my network and create a club where it's operated by a professional regulated GP, AIFMD compliant in Luxembourg, actually. And we come in as LPs, co-investors. It's all the AML checks, KYCs, everything is done by the regulated platform partners. And what I do on a daily basis is, you know, I'm searching and meeting with searchers, try to know where they are in their different parts of their journey, try to understand and get to know them, see what they're looking for. When they have something under LOI, they typically come to me and show me, talk to me about the deal. And I go from like an early screen to more a deep dive on searchers that I find interesting and that have interesting targets and under LOI. And then apply my kind of institutional frameworks and VC experience. So I've actually built my own kind of framework, which I called another acronym, sorry about that, but it's called the Best Fit Model, Best Fit Framework. In some cases, depending on how big or small we are in the allocation, we may take a board seat and enforce that that governance and reporting to our shareholders.
So interesting. You're trying to ascertain the extent to which those criteria are met pre-investment, but also quite happy to help shape them and achieve them post-investment.
Absolutely. Look, I think it's key. It depends on, you know, if it's a big deal where we're minority shareholders and small on the cap table, we may not get those things that we would like to have that we take off. But in that case, we'll certainly review what kind of the lead share investors have negotiated and see if that fits for us and who's on the board of the company. And for smaller deals, you know, maybe self-funded searchers, we would typically have a larger stake and maybe be the only investor alongside.
Take a more leading role, yeah. So you mentioned it's a club, and that's an important distinction. But it's a club with an AIFM, a GP, a regulated GP that is experienced and hopefully a safe pair of hands. The alignment of the stakeholders, how do you manage that? How do you keep everybody
aligned? Let me just finalize a little bit how the club works, just very quickly. So once we have the deal that we've identified in due diligence, we bring it to the platform. There's never any obligation to invest. So everybody comes in and makes their own investment decisions. We're not providing investment advice, recommendations, or arranging anything. But what we do is we'll organize a call with the searcher. We'll get everybody around the table or on the call, being able to ask questions. And that's where we really see the magic of the club, because everyone's pooling together and contributing really excellent questions for the benefit of all the members, which I think is really fascinating how that works, as opposed to kind of competing against each other for the deals. So and then basically members can put in flexible amounts, as long as, you know, it's a crowdfunding vehicle. You can put down as little down as you want, so several millions if you want, so from like 10,000 to several millions, depending on how much you want to put in, as long as collectively we get to the magic number that we're looking to raise. And then once that's done, we syndicate that, or our regulated platform partners syndicate that. They create an SPV in Luxembourg that's tax transparent and tax efficient. And we all come into the cap table as one investor. So that keeps it very simple and aligned with the searcher.
Great stuff.
And I guess in terms of alignment, which is your next question, I think, all these are deal by deal. There's never any obligation to invest. So there's perfect clarity on what you're getting into. I invest in all the deals personally, so I've got skin in the game. I mentioned governance, where we try to have a board seat or at least an observer seat. And in any case, I do pledge to reports and ensure there's reserve matters are covered. And then obviously there's the searcher's incentives, which is, you know, also a stake in incentives within the structure of the investment or the acquisition itself.
Well, let's drill down into the searchers, because obviously they are the one of the key components here. What do you look for specifically in the searchers that that you want to back?
Yeah, so look, I think, you know, I quite like people who have experience, so kind of mid-career type professional typically that can operate, who's got experience operating successfully. Obviously, I don't mind when there's been some setbacks. In fact, that's probably also a positive, but, you know, at least some success, hopefully. But also operating and scaling businesses. And if they have experience having bought a business before and even exited, that's also a bonus. We're seeing a lot of different types of buyers, from kind of self-funded searchers. We have dual searchers. We have kind of the search fund sponsored deals. We have the independent sponsors. So I'm a little bit agnostic at the moment, and maybe we'll hone down onto one of these in particular based on the feedback I get from the club and what their preference is. But, you know, they all command different dynamics and different economics as well. But what I do like to see is true grit from the entrepreneur, and having searched a company for 2 years certainly helps in demonstrating that they've achieved to, you know, to go through the highs and lows of that experience, I think, you know, showing true resilience and an attitude to get things done. But what's also very important is, I guess, a clear vision and strategy for growing EBITDA, taking over from the founder, making sure that the founder-led businesses is protected, and then just the high EQ. That's very, very important. Building rapport with the staff they're going to inherit, and honesty, transparency. I guess, you know, integrity is very key.
Yep. Yeah, so those soft skills, the people skills piece, I think that's absolutely vital in running a successful post deal growth phase. You need everybody to come with you, and if they don't trust you, they won't. So that sounds really clear as to what you're looking for. What do you hope, beyond the capital you're giving to these, why would you think these searchers would prefer to deal with a structure and an organization like this versus some of the more traditional routes?
Yeah, well, I mean, like you said earlier, everyone seems to be in need of equity gap funding for the best deals. You know, there's a lot of talk about no money down and all that, but that's I've yet to see a lot of those happening. So I think there's, you know, the ability for us to help guide them in being kind of investor ready and package their presentations and the way and the terms for investors. That's also very key. Some come from different walks of life, not necessarily experienced in talking to professional investors. So I think we can help shape that. You know, without specifically arranging or promoting the deal to our investors, but at least helping them on that front. I think it's also important for them or interesting to them to know that they can simplify their cap table where, you know, we come in as one investor. And in fact, we're having conversations with some of these investors who have searchers who have a number of investors, but are kind of putting in small tickets, and they're asking us to come and syndicate them for us, for them, so that they don't need to work with so many different lines on the cap table. So I think that's a quite interesting development. So we'll see if we move in that direction, but there's definitely interest there. And then I guess, you know, just less leverage, maybe in some cases removing any personal guarantees if there's senior secured debt involved or whatever. And I think what I'd love to see is kind of this ecosystem of network of investors from my community, where if, let's say, there's a specific project work that needs to be done within the company, maybe I can tap into the network. They all have different backgrounds in different industries. And maybe there's something I can plug in and do a project work from, like AI implementation or something, or CFO work or whatever. You know, it could be anything. And so hopefully
that's great. That's a real value add. So the fact that you're bringing all of these, you know, experienced, motivated investors, albeit aggregated into one nominee or SPV, actually there's personalities and you know, huge wisdom and experience behind those folks that could be allocated into some of these tasks and projects post acquisition. That's a real value add. Part of what we seek, isn't it? When we're acquiring, we want to surround ourselves with good people that have walked this journey before.
Yeah, absolutely.
Magic.
Yeah.
So where are you focusing your guns? I mean, you've obviously got the whole of Europe and beyond to play with here. Sector-wise and geography-wise, are there any particular areas that you are particularly excited about that you think is going to deliver more alpha than others?
Yeah, look, I think if I take out of my kind of my best fit approach, what I like to see is a perfect fit between the buyer and the target company, regardless of the industry or the sector and or the geography. So that's kind of the first and foremost.
So therefore, you would look for them to have experience in the space that they're acquiring in?
That helps for sure. But otherwise, kind of transferable skills that I think can work. I think there's opportunities in so many different things. I'm seeing companies like in kind of light manufacturing, you know, warehousing, logistics, industrial printing, HVAC obviously is a big one, industrial cleaning, construction. I mean, there's so many different things. And at the moment I've met like 63, I think it was, searchers on my database, and meeting, you know, a dozen a week, I guess, as well as investors who are approaching me to learn more about the club and potentially look at joining it. So being very selective, but it shows that, you know, I'm just building as we go, and there's a lot more ground to cover as well.
Busy man, you're going to need a team soon, which is going to need some revenue.
It's on the way.
indeed. Well, that's great, and very excited for your journey. Has it been plain sailing this far? I mean, you mentioned that you brought it into the world. The club is recent. Archimax is a bit older. Have there been any bumps in the road that you can speak to that others might learn from?
Yeah, look, I think, well, I kind of knew going into this, this is my third business now, I think I came certainly more prepared. And I think what challenges I faced was a little bit in the sequencing of the model. So I set up a holding company and buy a bunch of businesses, as I mentioned. It took a while, but eventually I found this kind of equity gap syndication idea. And I think that's where demand's really been confirmed from both sides. As I mentioned, lots of different searchers and investors on a weekly basis. It really seems like I've hit something quite interesting here. And I'm getting great feedback. People saying to me, look, I would never have found some of these deals without the club. And, you know, others saying that they've seen some of the due diligence stuff shared with them, which is completely on par with their expectations of, as private equity investors. And yeah, so it's the feedback's been overwhelmingly positive, actually, which is really encouraging.
Is there anything particularly that surprised you? Like, you know, you come from being an institutional investor to effectively being an entrepreneur and now a capital allocator in this space. Anything on that journey that has particularly, you know, stood out?
I think less so now than when I did my first venture, where it really hit me when I did that when you're on your own, you're on your own, and the buck stops with you. And at the moment, on my own, I'm discussing with different partners and opportunities, but it doesn't feel like I'm on my own. So I've got a lot of people surrounding me in different things and kind of supporting me on the sidelines. Yeah, so you know, it doesn't feel on my own, but I think it's important to get to that stage where you've built a lot of connections over the years and you can really tap into that as you venture on your own.
Hear, hear. Yeah, it's one of the benefits of getting on in years, as you've collected a lot of people along the way, and you're the same age as me, but I'm counting myself in that. You know, your network is your net worth or whatever it is, and I really value so many people that I've been able to meet and grow to admire over the years. So I think entrepreneurs and investors are going to get so much value from working with you. It's quite clear your experience goes a long way. Just to sort of start that off as part of the takeaways from this episode, have you got any particular pearls of wisdom to impart to the acquisition entrepreneurs? You know, for example, what kind of advice could you give them about working with investors?
I've always valued transparency and governance and, you know, telling it up straight when it's good or bad. I think that's builds a lot of credibility and trust, as opposed to kind of like, you know, just focusing on the good. And I think that's something I've learned along my life, where I've always seen that being the way to do it in the investment world, where you have to be transparent. So I think that's one. And, you know, build trust early, it attracts capital later, and keep on keeping us informed on how you're developing things, and work with people like us to ask us questions on how to present things or how to approach different things, and how to, you know, so very open to all discussions and to get to meet acquirers early in the process.
Nice, sound advice, sage wisdom. And on the other side of the coin with investors, you know, what might they benefit from knowing about this asset class as it starts to become a bit more mature?
There's definitely a place for it, for ETA investments alongside traditional assets. You know, it's uncorrelated, focus on cash flows, resilience, attractive entry levels. And it's, you know, we talk about something like 30% IRR historically in the US, but it's also important to remember to diversify across different operators and sectors in our case.
Sure. Now, I mean, just to double click on that, you mentioned earlier about, you know, the inherent concentration risk of the power law and how that's a bit wacky. But with the diversification of portfolio into these cash flowing assets, you know, how much diversification should one seek in building their portfolio? I mean, you know, it's not uncommon for VCs to have 20, 25 companies because one has to return the fund. Do you need the same spread in this space?
I think it depends on the risk appetite. Some people might have, and the, you know, how much money they have to invest. And some people might want more diversification, and some people might want more concentrated bets. You know, I've had situations in my hedge fund world where some portfolios had like 500 names, but they were doing kind of like arbitrage opportunities and things like that. And others had very concentrated investments of kind of long short equities of like 10 names on each side or not even. And I think to each their own, really. But the beauty of my model is that you can pick and choose. You know, you can create your customized portfolio naturally, diversifying as the more you participate in these deals. And you can have your own biases towards different sectors, different countries, different, or, you know, or not. And I think that's makes it very flexible and attractive for investors.
Yeah, it's the boring buffet.
Exactly.
Cool. So I ask all our guests to sort of mentally transport themselves forward 12 months. God knows that gets here quick. But if we were to talk to you again in 12 months, what would you like to have achieved with both Archimax and the investment club during that time?
Obviously, growing the membership with selected parties and, you know, very keeping it quite exclusive and tight so that it's very collegiate. I do have a no asshole policy. I don't know if I can say that on the podcast, but I think that's quite important. So we're all working together and for the benefit of everyone. And then, you know, building track record, a good track record of identifying good deals, reporting obviously on them and closing on them. And I think, you know, I do have, like I said, clear ideas on additional verticals within the space that I plan to roll out with partners within my company. So we'll see how we get on with that. But all excited.
Yeah, fabulous. It is exciting and made all the better by having a no arsehole policy, I think. we're very keen on that. Good. So how can people reach you? What's the best channels and you know, URLs, whatever, to fly to?
Yeah, well, I'm on LinkedIn. I think that's where I do most of my social media. So linkedin.com/in/AlexanderKalis, K-A-L-I-S. Or otherwise through my website, archimax.solutions. And otherwise get in touch with Gareth and he'll put me in touch with me, hopefully. And
there is that, absolutely. I'm more than happy to be the super connector, but we'll also put all those links in the show notes so that you don't have to wait for me. Great, cool. Well, I mean, that's super exciting and love what you're doing. Love the content that you're busily putting out too. Really informative, educational stuff. It's lovely to see, and you've quickly become a strong advocate for this community and a great conduit for people that want to explore this asset class. And so thank you for what you're doing, and long may it continue. To your success, sir. Yeah.
Thanks to you as well for playing a big part in my discovery of the asset class. And I think BizCrunch has been a wonderful and needed business for the community. So well done on that.
Fabulous. Thanks for that. High praise. Good stuff. Well, Alex, in which case, I want to bid you adieu. Say thank you very much for all that you have done today on this podcast. It's been a really interesting conversation. And we look forward to charting your progress. Listeners, look forward to seeing you again next week. And until then, keep on crunching.
Thanks. Bye-bye.